hubbub, a chaotic din caused by a crowd of people. So, welcome to Hubbub, the Directors Hub Founders Support Club, and our podcast series, Season 4, Episode 4. So, we are here today with Carl Elwood of Elwood Wines, and we're going to be talking to him today, and, well, several questions along the line. Before I forget, because oh, she's sitting next to me, Faye Miller of Gingerbread World is also joining me as my co-host, and I'm Sonny Cutting of Network Express. So, welcome, Carl.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Great to be here.
Good to have you here, Carl. Nice Thank to talk you. To you finally about wine. Yay!
Absolutely. Yay! Yeah, I know. I hardly ever talk about the subject, but just this once, I thought I'd make an exception, as it is a Friday.
What I want to know, as it is a Friday, is where are the samples?
I know.
I wasn't expecting that. A bottle of white wine. It's just not on.
It's funny, when I've been to networking events and the usual question is, what do you do? And I say, well, I'm in the wine business. And so they start looking around under the table expecting me that every time I go to an event, I'm going to be carrying bottles of wine. Some might be happy with that, but maybe the venues won't always be happy.
No, I'm sure they won't, especially if you're trying to...
I'll get a bad reputation.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, we are here to talk about wine anyway, and specifically, you being an independent wine merchant, how you got into that, and then in a wider context, I suppose the changes in the wine industry that you've seen over the last, since 1986 you first started in the business, didn't you? The last three decades, I suppose, and also, how English wine has risen in prominence and all those things. So we'll get to it anyway. But tell us how you started in the business first off.
It was by mistake, really. Basically, I had finished at what is now Kennedy Brooks University. It was then Oxford Polytechnic.
Okay.
And I finished unceremoniously, let's say. And my father was rather fed up with me just sort of kicking around at home. And he said, look, Carl, why don't you... I've got a client of mine who is a wine merchant, and would you like to go and pick some grapes in France? And I thought, yeah, why not? It was good to practice on my French, get that going. And I thought, great, there'd be lots of young French women around. I thought, it's a win-win. Totally. So, I was 18 at this stage. And that date to pick grapes didn't actually happen for whatever reason. So what happens, I ended up working for the wine merchant in question.
Yeah.
And what really happened there is it opened up my eyes to a world I had no idea existed.
Yeah.
Because bear in mind, I was 18 or 19. I wasn't really interested in wine. Yes, beer. But wine was there, but I really didn't engage with it as much. And I was the wingman to one of his drivers. I think his name was Tony. And he never did any lifting. He just did the driving. So he saw this young lad next to him. I was ruthlessly exploited. And we drove all around London at the back streets where the entrance to the restaurants, the good deliveries were, goods in.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like a hidden club, a bit like a speakeasy. I imagine like Chicago in the 1930s, these tiny little doorways which were not designed for trolleys, wheeling boxes down these spiral stairs, desperate not to drop them. And then go through these little back through to the kitchens. Everyone's really busy. It's frantic. I learned not to stand next to a chef or anyone working in the kitchen at any point because you got shouted at.
So the
whole point was quite a brutal baptism of fire, but it was an eye-opener for me.
Yeah.
And I just loved that. So I saw that end of it. And then I ended up working in cellars. Then I ended up working in sales.
Yeah.
You either become a buyer or a seller.
Yeah.
Ended up in sales, don't know why. But this is a largely a French-speaking company, and my French wasn't good enough to really to work within that team so effectively. So I ended up working for this other guy. So it was always word of mouth within the industry.
Right.
And that really helped me through to when I did ultimately pick grapes. And that is why I do what I do. So this crazy Belgian called Jean-Marie Gouffins. And he had a tiny holding of vines in Mâcon.
Yeah.
So I went up there as this young lad, and it was backbreaking work, working with a team of about 15 other pickers. And in the early hours of the morning, he'd wake me up from my slumber, take me down to the cellars or the cuverie, and encourage me to help him with the winemaking. Not so much the winemaking, sorry, that sounds a bit grand, but he had this old 17th century Cocard press. It's sort of like an Aston Martin of presses back in the 17th century.
Wow.
And he'd stand at one end of a pole and I at the other, and we would just rotate, the only light being a light bulb just swinging above us. You'd hear the sound of the wine as the juice of it as it fell into the bucket.
Like something from a Hollywood film.
It was amazing. Absolutely. And I think what changed in me is that I had no idea where wine actually came from. And the key point, I think, for me was it was the personality behind the wine. And that's something I say now. I didn't know it then, but in recent times talking about wine, I realized how important that experience was for me.
Yeah.
And it took a while to realize, why do I do what I do? Because there's people who make wine, which I didn't really think about as a 19, 20-year-old at this stage. And there's people who drink wine. And there's that connection between the winemaker and the wine consumer that's often overlooked.
Yeah.
So if I can connect the dots by telling stories, I think of myself as a story seller. So if I can, through my vault of stories that puts the personality behind the wine, that's why what I do. And that's why I enjoy, actually, what I do.
That's very true, because if you buy a bottle of wine from the supermarket, you don't really have... Unless you actively go looking for it, you don't have any idea really of the provenance of it, other than, oh, it's from South America, or it's from New Zealand, or it's from Spain, or wherever. You don't really know about what the growers have gone through to produce that bottle of wine, do you? There is a real disconnect there, I suppose.
There is. What I really find rewarding is if I do a wine tasting and I start relaying my description of the winemaker, or where they're from, what their philosophy is, or their heritage... That really opens up people's imaginations, so that when they go home, and if they've bought that wine, that's the story they'll tell their friends. Mm. That's what they remember.
Yeah.
So yes, you go into a supermarket, let's say, and it will tell you a little bit about it. It might have a nice label and the price is good, but it's a bit impersonal.
Yeah. So you were in sales, and you learned all about the winemaking process there, which sounds absolutely fascinating. Honestly, I can see this French film with Juliette Binoche in it and something going on there. It sounds really cool.
That sounds fine.
But, but how did you go from sales into your own business? At what point did you make the leap and why?
When I was 38, 39,
I
just had a son. Yeah. And I was thinking, I'm not going to be my ex-wife then, and myself and my son were due to think about, well, we're going to move. We're going to need to move at some point. And we decided, well, where do we go? Now, at the time, we thought we should go down to Brighton. We had friends there. We've always visited Brighton. So we knew that's where we're going to move to. So we're about to move down to Brighton. And I was stuck on a train. Going to work, thinking, gosh, if I'm in Brighton, I'm going to have this on a regular basis. Yeah. How's that going to feel? So I spoke to a good friend of mine who lived in Brighton and worked in London. I said, what's it like? He says, it's expensive, unpredictable and stressful. Yeah. And that's just getting to work. Yeah. And I thought, right, okay, do I need this? Do I want this?
Yeah.
So, move on another year. And I was feeling, right, I need to sort this out. So I decided I'd join forces with a former colleague.
Yeah.
Who had already set up a business down in Sussex. And I decided, if I don't do that before I'm 40, will I regret it? And I thought, well, I may as well try, even if I fail, rather than fail trying. So I just decided to take the leap of faith. And there never is an ideal time, I think, to do this. But that was really what motivated me, was simply, if I'm in a beautiful area like Brighton, why on earth do I want to spend half my life on a train?
That is true, actually, because that commute is a killer if you ever have to do it, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, I do it still, but actually on my terms.
Yeah, I suppose if it's your own business and when you're choosing to go, when you have to do it every day, then it's a bit different. Although, mind you, a lot of people don't have to do it so much anymore now. But so you set up Elwood Wines, and like you said, your philosophy is story selling, if you like, selling the stories behind the wine. So is that what you look for was that always been your ethos with the business, and what you look for when you source wines for the business?
It's evolved.
Yeah.
When I talk about wines, when you do a presentation, you can kind of feel the room and you get an idea what level of information is resonating.
Yeah.
And you just, it's an instinct, you just know, partly because you can just see by eye contact how people are reacting. If they start looking down as if they're on their phones, you'll know you're off target.
Okay.
People respond to stories about people. So it evolved, and I couldn't say how long it's evolved for. I suspect I've always done it.
Yeah.
If I think back to incidences in my career, I remember them.
Yeah.
And I think it's because it resonated with me. And I know, I believe I speak more, even more passionately about a wine when I start relaying a story. And I think that that is really more important. Yes, there are consumers who like to know technical details, grape varieties, yields, how the wine is made, aged, and so on. And that's absolutely fine. But that's not, in my experience at least anyway, not what everyone wants to know. So when I do go to tastings, particularly say up in London, the first thing I'm looking at is, what's your story?
Yeah.
Why should I care?
Yeah.
Because I think there's enough wine out there, and any customers, anyone you speak to, whether they admit it or not, is why should I care? And in business, is if you understand what makes them tick, what they care about, and then you find a product, in my case wine, that resonates with their values in some shape or form, then that's when someone cares. And if they care enough, it tastes better. Everything in life is better when it's cared, like food.
Yes.
You know, food made with love is always going to taste better than just something that's thrown in front of you.
That is true. So with your with the wine, when you do presentations and wine tastings, do you choose the wines that you're going to get them to taste based on sort of the background, the backstories to them as much as anything?
Yes and no. I try to be fair and reflect their interests too. It's not all about me.
Yeah.
But if I put that into a mix, so there's an element of what the customer wants.
Yeah.
I always ask, what are you looking for? What do you want to get out of this?
Yeah.
Now, more often than not, they'll say, fine, I'll leave it up to you, Carl. But I would like to inject something of value that they want. Again, that brings into why would they care?
Yeah.
Because they're interested. And if you can maintain someone's interest and you're doing a presentation for an hour and a half, you know they're going to be listening long enough and it's going to be of value to them.
Yeah.
But then I also like to think of a theme. So there is a story. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. From a presentational point of view, if for me, because I tend to do presentations without notes, I have them, but they're just like a storyboard.
Yeah.
But if there's a thread to A to Z in the story, I'm more likely to remember what it is that I meant to say.
Yeah.
Not always. So the story has to be something that means something to me that's relevant to what we're doing.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of both, really.
So when you sort of source wines for your business, how does that work? Do you sort of visit the growers and find out about them, find all about their history and how they've come to be? Is that what informs what you do?
Yeah, basically. I mean, it recently I've not had much time to visit wine producers with a younger family when I started it. It wasn't really viable.
Yeah.
Fortunately, being based down in Brighton, not far from London, still is very much a massive centre for the wine world, the commercial world of wine. So a lot of producers will visit the UK. Because I'm dealing with smaller producers, that tends to be their domain, their vineyard, so you can connect with them pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But yes, when you do visit a domain or a wine estate, you have in your own mind an image of that and then relaying how that looks.
Yeah.
So yes, visiting, that you can't beat actually being on the soil with the winemakers.
Yeah. Are there many in, I guess there are quite a few in Sussex, I guess.
What, winemakers? Yeah. Yeah, I do visit them. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Or do you find that most of the wines that you select are based around the UK or probably internationally, I would say?
Most are overseas. Yeah. Most are within sort of the European continent, if you like. I mean, yes, English wine, that's a recent development, as you mentioned at the beginning about how English wine, Sussex in particular, has really catapulted English wine to the world stage at an exceptionally high level.
Isn't that it's partly to do with the landscape and climate as well? Because our downs are not, isn't the soil not dissimilar to the Champagne region in France, hence why things like Ridgeview do really well?
Yeah, it's a chunk of soil, land, rock, whatever you want to call it, called the Paris Basin.
Yeah.
Is that what it's known as?
Yeah. And basically going way, way back.
Yeah.
When obviously the UK broke away from the continent and it rotated. So the soil is identical in the South Downs, to be specific, which taps into parts of Kent, as well as, I think, and in Hampshire as well, which I think is the extension of South Downs. I'm sure someone listening may well correct me on that. Yeah. But in principle, yes.
Yeah.
The difference is climatically, we're just about half a degree on average less than, say, in Champagne, or maybe even slightly less than that.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting thing, climate change. And it's a factor.
Yeah.
And it's certainly a topic you see a lot more now in Europe, of where there are challenges because of global warming.
What, in terms of impacting wine production or changing it, perhaps?
I think there's concerns and shift in agricultural patterns. But what we're looking at is, you see, winemakers are great innovators. So they will plant with a different aspect. For example, most vineyards are planted south and southwest facing. Get more sun that way. Global warming in the future would suggest that's not the best wisdom. You want to keep your vines away from constant heat.
Okay.
So then you may plant north and northwest facing.
Wow. Yeah.
So we're going to start to see that, that's for sure. But the other factor is that, and this is what I love about it, actually, a lot of wine producers are now looking back in history to winemaking techniques from centuries ago in order to manage intelligently what nature is delivering to them. So rather than saying to nature, God, we're going to have to change everything, it's a battle, say, no, if let's think about how we're making wine. That's what's changed in Sussex, for example. Yeah, global. It's not fair, actually, to the standard set by winemakers in England to say, oh, because the temperature's gone up, that's why you can make the wine. Yeah. That's actually missing the point.
That's
because
doing them a disservice.
Totally,
then,
it's intelligent winemaking. I think it's viticultural changes over the last 50 years have transformed wine far more than the challenges that global warming has, which is a challenge. Yeah. I'm not trying to undermine that.
No.
But there are techniques in winemaking, viticultural, that allows us as a consumer to still get the wines we want. So Bordeaux aren't going to suddenly stop making wine in the near future, bar any major disaster.
Yeah.
But then global warming brings climate changes such as weather patterns.
So that's
another challenge, you know.
Yeah, well, as you say, it would be doing them a disservice just to say they're doing better wine just because, you know, we've got warmer weather coming along and everything, you know. But there has been a real, because, you know, going back when I was a kid and my parents were drinking wine, English wine was just dreadful. You know, no one bought it because it was so bloody awful. So there's been a real change because now you've got ones that are, as you say, doing really well on the world stage. I mean, take Ridgeview at Ditchling, for example, because they've won the best sparkling wine in the world award at least twice, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Beating some of the major champagnes and everything. So that, you know, there's been a real sea change in terms of what you can get that's produced locally as well as abroad.
Absolutely. The global attitude's changed. You know, you look at France.
Yeah.
You go to any top restaurant in Paris and you will find English wine.
You will now. Wow.
Yeah.
That is a real change,
isn't
it?
You know, that is. But they have to. I mean, it's just foolish just to think because it's English, not going to buy it. And that doesn't make sense either. If you look at a top sommelier looking after the wine list for a top restaurant in Paris, his passion or her passion in wine will dictate you've got to look at English wine.
Yeah.
And they do.
It's a nice accolade to have, though, isn't it, for British manufacturers as such, for like Ridgeview and Bolney Wine Estate and so forth, to be on that kind of stage. It's amazing.
Oh, absolutely. And now, of course, because the Champenoises can't plant any more vines. The region, they've been told no.
Oh, that's it. Really?
It's done. So if they want to expand the region,
they
can't. If they want to increase production. Although, in fact, in Champagne, they've been slowly reducing production and maintaining quality. So instead they're buying vineyard areas up in the UK. Tattinger have bought some vines, some land. They've planted vines in Kent.
Yeah.
I believe it's Kent. But you see, they're taking a long-term view. They probably won't offer anything commercially for maybe 20 years.
Yeah.
Not until the wine is to the quality that they expect.
Yeah.
So they're playing the long game, but the cost of land in the UK is a fraction of the cost in Champagne. We don't have quite the same wine regulations in the UK, which is great for innovation. Yeah. Another reason why English wine is such a success. You can almost do what you want.
Yeah.
Within reason. Whereas in champagne, you've got several hundred years of rules that you cannot break.
God, so, that must be complicated
to deal with.
Yeah,
that's
so
insane.
Yeah, and it's a lengthy list.
Yeah.
But you see, that protects the producer because it says what it does on the tin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it protects the consumer because it says what it does on the tin. So
because
it's got
to have that. It's got to be grown in the Champagne region to have that appellation on it, hasn't it? You can't call it, even if it's very similar or virtually identical, if it's grown not in Champagne, it's sparkling wine, isn't it? Or
absolutely. And they're very protective of that. So even the word Champagne can't be used outside of Champagne. I mean, I think it possibly might be some parts of the world. But, you know, they have fought hard to preserve their, you know, their legacy.
Yeah.
And... And I think, you know, we'll probably see similar things, no doubt, in Sussex at some point.
Yeah.
Introductions to similar regulations. Yeah. Is Sussex Fizz so different to sparkling wine from Kent or Dorset or Cornwall that they have to, they have their own little demarcated zones?
Yeah.
Mm. We'll see. We'll see.
But it's not just the English wines that are doing well. You've got the, is it New World or New World? I can never remember. But things like New Zealand and then the South American wines, the Chilean, Argentinian, South African, you know, California as well. You know, my sister lives near Appledore County, which I believe is quite a big wine producing region. She goes and gets a lot of wine anyway. she does. She's part of a club. That makes her sound like she's an alcoholic. She's not. She just likes good wine.
No, likes to be part of a wine club.
A discerning consumer.
A discerning consumer, definitely. But, you know, so much is changing. So you've got, I suppose, what you would class as sort of more, like you say, the French have been making it for hundreds of years and the Spanish and the Italians. But then moving further out, you've got other countries that are producing some brilliant bottles now as well.
Absolutely. And that's part of the story.
Yeah.
I think one of the challenges I have in my business is when talking to someone who's new, and then one of the key questions they ask is, what do you like?
Yeah.
And they'll give me a list of wines, is to encourage them to venture left, just to go left field off their normal choice. Otherwise, there's a tendency just to drink the same thing every single time, which is dull.
Yeah.
And the only way you can learn about wine is to taste. It's one of the great gifts that our palate has. So variety is the spice of life. Mm. So trying to encourage someone to try something different. And so knowing the story about grapes around the world is one way of communicating that.
Yeah.
And so Sauvignon Blanc, if you say Sauvignon Blanc, more often than not, someone now thinks immediately of New Zealand.
Yes, that is true.
But if you went back 30 years ago and you said Sauvignon Blanc, they'll think France and they'll probably think Sancerre Puy Fumé.
Yeah.
That's an evolution, that's a change.
Yeah.
And talking to someone who only drinks Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand and they said, I really don't like it anymore. I said, well, have you tried a Sancerre? I said, oh yeah, I do like that. And then, but they may not have known it's actually Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah.
But again, that's just part of telling the story first and then explaining a bit more about the wine itself second.
Do you encounter resistance from people who've like, well, that's what I've always drank. I've always drunk a Rioja or whatever. And then encourage them to try something different. Do you find that people are hesitant to do that? And how do you overcome that with them and get them to try something different that they might be really surprised by and really like?
It's a challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, one way we do that is we have this tasting program called the Wine Discovery Program, which is a way of enabling someone to taste some wine, curated based on their own palate. And I'll throw in a few curveballs as well in there because I like to do that and see their reaction. More often than not, surprises them more than me. But it's getting them to taste a wine that they may think, well, if it's going to cost me £15 or £20 a bottle, that's the difficulty. Price isn't the true reason people hesitate.
Yeah.
Often it's because they just don't know yet whether they'll like it or not. And so it is a challenge, but that's one way of doing it. But you're right. There will always be someone who will say, no, that's what I like and that's what I want.
So, like a lot of the bottles and the vintages that you sell, are they, to all intents and purposes, single origin wines from, you know, one vineyard as opposed to, because I think some of the supermarkets, a lot of the mass produced stuff is blended, isn't it, with multiple different grapes from different places. Is yours more particular? Can you tell me a bit more about that?
That's a very good question. The only reason I'm hesitating is I'm thinking of an intelligent answer to such an intelligent question. Wines can be a blend wherever they're from. Say, for example, in Bordeaux, traditionally they are a blend.
Okay.
I mean, nature found a way to say, this grape will ripen at different stages.
Yeah.
So Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot, those are the two principal grapes in Bordeaux, for example. Cabernet ripens later than Merlot.
Okay.
Now, if the weather's awful, early harvest, you get the Merlot in fast.
Yeah.
If it's really good, well, Merlot can just sit and chill on the vines. It's quite good because it has naturally higher sugar levels, gives wines a bit more power, oomph, if that's what you want, if you want these big full-bodied wines. Cabernet Sauvignon has thicker skins.
Okay,
can handle that weather a bit more, can handle good weather and bad weather, but it can be left on the vine for longer.
Yeah.
So having the two grape varieties gives a winemaker the necessary ingredients to make their wine.
Yeah.
That's why vintage variation is so important.
Yeah.
You'll get good years, bad years. I mean, that is subjective.
Yeah.
That's one of the key things I always say about wine, actually, when I think of it. There's no right or wrong. Everyone has an opinion. Your opinion is just as valid as mine.
Yeah.
So it, by having a blend, gives a winemaker an opportunity to do something special.
Yeah.
And that's traditional in Bordeaux, and that's you very rarely get single varietals in Bordeaux. You can, but generally speaking. So the blend can be, from the wines I deal with, part of the region it's from.
Yeah.
The sort of things I look for, really, are wines that are just a little unique.
Yeah.
And it's often smaller producers. They tend the vines themselves. They know them really, really well.
Yeah.
The vines are a bit older. Production levels are lower. They're wines that you will not see in the shops. So there's that element about wines that fall below the radar.
Right.
And it makes it more fun. Say if you were to buy a wine from me, Faye, and you said, you know, I've got this from Cannes and you can't get it anywhere else except me. That makes it a really special, hopefully, a really special purchase for you. So when you talk about it, your friends will think, well, aren't we the lucky ones? Look what Faye's got for us. And, you know,
special.
Where do I find Carl? Things
does,
like that.
Well, it does make it more special, doesn't it? I mean, as a wine connoisseur, what is something that you would like people to know more about?
Firstly, I mean, this is quite an interesting point. The word connoisseur, one of the main things, I'll just rewind that statement actually. Wine merchants can and appear to be quite a scary bunch. We tend, I think what happens is that everyone expects that you have to be some form of connoisseur in order to buy wine of value. And by value, I don't mean price. I just mean the quality and price ratio. So whatever you feel you can afford. And it's interesting when you talk to a connoisseur, say an art connoisseur, and you went into a very fine gallery in Bond Street, and then you went in, you said, I'd like to buy a painting, please. You know there are no prices on there. That's quite intimidating. And it's so therefore the joy of art and just enjoying it can be a little tricky. So the first thing I say when anyone's looking to buy wine, back to what I said a couple of minutes ago, is that your opinion is as valid as anyone else's. So that's probably the first thing I would try and say to someone. And that's what I try and do, is just to say, let's try some wines together and you tell me what you think. I mean, someone will know what they like, but they don't know why. And what I try to unlock and what I really have fun when I get to that moment is helping someone discover their why they like a wine. And when they know their why, it empowers them to be a better wine consumer, not necessarily with me. They could be buying from anyone else. That's absolutely fine. But unlocking that why is really, really important. So that's probably the key thing, is I'd steer away from connoisseur because it's a phrase that's often used, and try and make it more accessible by just switching it around and saying, you know, you tell me. And then it unlocks, you'll be able to articulate about wine in a way you had no idea you could already.
Oh, interesting, because I love Merlot.
Okay.
I mean, I spent a lot of time just outside of Bordeaux over a year in a lovely place called Saint-Emilion, which is a beautiful place, beautiful place for wine. Merlot is by far one of my favourite wines ever. I would love to try something else other than Merlot. There's your challenge.
Let me fire a question back at you then, Sonny. Just reversing the tables a little bit here.
Oh, no.
What is it about Merlot that you like? How does it make you feel? Is a good start, I think.
Yeah, it just makes me feel. It makes me feel a lot happier. It's just full bodied.
Okay.
There's not a heaviness to it. It's just they're just really fruity, you know. And you can taste those nodes all the way through the wine. And you can't always do that with wine. Sometimes it's quite flat, if that makes sense.
It does. But there you go. You see, you've just described to me Merlot, and I think what you just said would probably resonate with a lot of people. So, you know why you like Merlot, and there are other great varieties that I think you'd probably like as well. But we don't have time to go through
them. Well, you'll have to introduce those to me later.
Yeah, well, one of the best wines I ever had was a Bordeaux. When I was living in France, and I was in Rennes in Brittany, that's where I used to live. And so we went to this traditional Breton restaurant, but actually they bought this bottle of Bordeaux, and it was just beautiful because it was so full-bodied but so smooth. It just slipped down so beautifully. And I've never had a red wine quite like it since. And that one, that was like 25 years ago, and it still sticks in my mind today. And the other one I really loved was Rui, Chanson Père et Fils, which was one of your tasting events, I think probably not long after you just started out. And that was also absolutely beautiful as well. And I can't remember why, but it just stuck in my mind ever since as being really amazing.
I was going to have to put my hand up in the podcast. Like, why have I put my hand up?
Sonny, it's not
I'm so sorry. Yeah, I mean, another one that I like is Chateau Margaux, which is also another one, which is just stunning. But you try and buy them in the UK and they are, excuse my language, they are fucking extortionate. Yeah. But if you go to France, it's a fraction of the cost. Oh, I swore. Yeah. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
That's all right. You got one in.
Yeah.
I'm honoured.
I'm sure it won't get beat later.
I mean, it's a very good point. And when I set up, is that one of the things I learned over the years is that you don't have to go to the very fine and mighty wine producing estates to get the greatest wines.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of, they're locked in. And any aspiring winemaker who wants to make their mark in the world of wine will have to be perhaps a little bit more practical or pragmatic and where they can buy. And the great established regions are expensive to get investment to buy vineyards. Most haven't been born into the trade, if you like. So they have to start from the bottom up. And they've probably already spent a fortune learning to become a winemaker in the first place.
It's a long game, isn't it?
So it is.
I mean, how long does it take from, you know, when you first plant vines to being able to actually harvest and make a decent wine from it?
Depends on the variety and where you are, but sort of anywhere between around about 8 years, probably.
Which is a long time to wait, isn't it?
But the quality may not be what you aspire for until maybe they reach 20 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. There is a market for younger vines to sell to. You could sell to a cooperative. So there are ways of turning in a bit of money, but it's expensive business and it's a long haul game. And you do require friendly banks. And banks aren't always as friendly as we would like. And we understand it.
Yeah.
I mean, certain things have happened in the economy over the years. But if you find a winemaker who is punching above their weight, and they are producing exceptional wines at great prices. That's why I call value.
Yeah.
Then it is possible. I mean, Chateau Margaux, yes, they are expensive. Maybe justifiably so. It depends. It's what you think it's worth paying for. You know, I had a client once who said they balked at the idea of spending £20 per bottle on a box of wine. Yet the reason why we were putting together a really nice selection of wines is because they had a brand new kitchen. Now, I know how much they spent on that kitchen, which for me, I thought, man, that's a lot of money. But that's what they valued most was the kitchen. So they didn't value really expensive wines. Once I realized that, I thought, fine, we actually became with a more modest level of wines. They now actually spend a bit more on wine. But that's... It's finding that sweet spot of what someone values, and we don't always value the same things.
It's all about perception, isn't it? I mean, that's in essence what it is. I mean, that's what I love about the Business Leaders Wine Club. You know, the other service that you offer within your business, being that it enables people to come along and taste those different wines which you would not normally have access to.
Yeah, well, the Business Leaders Wine Club. And thank you for bringing that up.
Yes, here's our shameless plug.
I know, it's so professional.
Wine club.
That's what I say.
Us all about
thank you, and I will take that, and I'll exploit that as best I can. That came about, interestingly enough, after lockdown. when we all started to get back out in the big wide world. Just prior to that, I was doing a lot of online networking. And so fast forward to the first time we're out in lockdown, I think it was April, sometime in April after we all came out, and there was I did a wine tasting, and I was looking around the room, and it was really well attended, but I was aware that a lot of people who I had never met face to face before knew one another. Mm. And they were so happy to see one another, and they were networking, and they were talking business. And many of them had brought their partners with them. I mean life partners, not professional partners. And it occurred to me, while one group is standing around talking business and the other group is sort of trying to be friendly and sociable, I thought, what's the etiquette on that? Yeah. To go to an event, say, oh, come on, we're going to go to this event, and then you end up talking business all the time. It's perhaps not necessarily the right thing to do. So I thought, well, okay, how do we resolve that? Well, you make it actually the purpose of a wine tasting involving networking. But what was the other observation is how wine is a great icebreaker and a conversation starter. So where two business owners don't know one another, mm. they can talk about the wine first. And then inadvertently, they're talking about themselves, their personality in a way that's not obvious.
Yeah.
And before they know it, they've been speaking for 20 minutes without once mentioning what it is their business is or what they do. And when that happens, I think that's great yeah. because business is about personalities. I mean, we all know that.
Yeah.
You know, it's building lasting connections is only with the people that you relate with yeah. most, or you know, you feel connected to.
Yeah.
And we go to enough networking events where it is very much business first, personality second.
Yes.
So I wanted to try and reverse that. So it's personality first. You can talk business for a bit at Business mm-hmm. Leaders Wine Club, but more often what happens, someone organizes a one-to-one afterwards. And that's what we've seen happening. So it's wine is the icebreaker, the thread, the common thread between everybody. They all share an interest in wine. No one's an expert. Not really.
Yeah.
They have an opinion, just like me. You know, I'm an expert in the sense of being in the business for a long, long time. But everyone has an opinion, and I love that. It levels the playing field enormously. So it doesn't matter whether their business is bigger than your business. Well, that's irrelevant, because you're looking at a wine together for the first time that neither of you shared an opinion on before. And I think that really means a conversation can get going without any sense yeah. of being totally self-aware.
Yeah. And you have cheese at the event as well, don't you? It's all...
That's
part of it.
Yes, yeah. obviously,
brilliant.
Which I know Sonny's not a big fan of the cheese.
Yeah, but I love wine,
yes,
so you know,
there you go.
Who doesn't?
Absolutely. But yeah, cheese is a big part of it.
Yeah,
We are very fortunate. We have a sponsor, Curds and Whey, and the Great British Charcuterie yeah. Company. So I know they'll be happy to hear me mention them. And you know, sponsorship's a really important yeah. part in running networks, as you know, Sonny, with what you do. But the cheese is part of that story, and wine... particularly the wines that we're showing at Business Leaders Wine Club, need some help.
Yeah.
And wine's flavours
yeah.
or our relationship with it changes based on what we eat.
Yeah.
So I often say, if you had a wine you weren't too sure of, go and try that cheese over there, then try it again and see if it's changed. And 9 times out of 10 it has. Maybe you prefer it, maybe you don't, but it does change. So the cheese is a big part of it. And the charcuterie is another big part of it. And particularly, it's all English charcuterie, all sort of artisanal charcuterie, yeah. specifically actually from Sussex.
Wow, that's a nice...
Because it's nice to support the local local industry like that,
yeah.
which has been rather overlooked over yes. the years. So that's it. Yeah, that is a massive part of
yeah.
it.
And you're sold out for your upcoming event, aren't you?
I know, which is great.
Yeah.
Growing a network like that does take time, and we wanted it to grow slowly, yeah. but equally, you've got to keep pushing it,
yeah.
and we wanted to get some new members along, so it was a Bring a Colleague,
yeah.
or will be a Bring a Colleague event in May,
yeah.
so that's why that sold out much more quickly. I mean, 3 weeks before the event, we sold out. We have not sold out that quickly before.
Yeah.
But the numbers are growing.
Yeah.
And it's never going to be a big... We're not looking for big numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, normally it's 20, 25.
Yeah.
So it's really a small, intimate
yeah,
event.
It's a nice group, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's... Yeah, everyone can talk. Doesn't get cliquey. And it means you walk into a room, there's a good chance you're going to speak to every single person in that room.
Yeah. It sounds like a fantastic event. I'm gutted I can't come along to it this time.
We have to come to another one.
Next one's on a bus, isn't it?
I'm not drinking at the moment, so, you know, much as I'd love to be drinking, I'm not at the moment. I will be in June, though. So end of June, I'll be drinking again. So.
Well, maybe on the buses. Well, exactly. Sunny's been on the bus when we did last year.
Yeah, I was a little bit... I had a few too many tipples, so I decided when at Ridgeview that instead of getting the bus back, I kind of cheated and pressed Uber. And found one in Burgess Hill, which I could not believe, to be fair. Obviously, I'm detracting from the wine story. But sorry. It got me home in like 10 minutes. But the stories and the people that you meet on the bus whilst you're savouring wine and learning about people is brilliant. Because you don't... We on the bus, on the way out to Ridgeview, I didn't talk about my business at all. Mm. It was lovely. It was all about the people. Just learning where they're from, what they, you know, do in their spare time when they don't have a business. And it was lovely. It was nice to not talk about business for a change.
Yeah, that makes me really happy to hear you say that. Definitely, because that's one of the key things and why it works, I believe.
It does sound really nice. Because trouble with networking events sometimes is they can get a bit what I would term billy business, if you know what I mean, where you do feel like you've sort of got to do your elevator pitch or, you know, to 20 different people and you're like... Oh my God, they think I'm a dick or whatever. You know, it's really hard to... So I think wine just breaks the ice in a way that other things don't sometimes.
I agree. And I think also there needs to be some events. I don't know if you're like me, that you have a set group of events you go to, but there are some that you know are going to be fun. Mm. And I think it's so important to have an event where, the old cheesy statement of it's networking, but not working.
Yeah.
In a positive sense. So it doesn't feel like work.
Yeah,
and I think that's really, really important because we relax more.
Yeah, because there are some events you go to and you're like almost
contrived,
grit your teeth and go, right, I'm going to do this for an hour and put my grin on my face and off we go. And then you're like, oh, thank God, that's over. But whether you get value out of it or not is another matter because you feel like that to start with. But if you feel like you're really enjoying it and you can relax into it, then you do get genuine value out of it. You know, something like
absolutely, and if we continue to be hopefully continue to be successful making them fun and enjoyable events, people will want to come back. Because it's really important. The value of a networking, the success of a networking organization is the quality of the people who attend. And in order to ensure there's always new faces, you need to have a reason why someone should want to come back, or better still, talk about it, tell their colleagues, business associates, why they think, you know, this is a particularly good one. And there are some really good ones in Sussex. We're really lucky. I think it's a bit of a mecca for great networking opportunities in Sussex that I don't really genuinely don't see anywhere else. I mean, I do some in London. And it's a completely different atmosphere to Sussex or Brighton in particular.
People, I don't know, maybe it's the Brighton effect, but people seem more creative and more open to fun or alternative networking ideas down here. Or so it seems to me anyway. So anything that sort of is out of the ordinary, where you're not doing that billy business thing, it's got to be a good thing, I think.
Absolutely.
And back to the wine, all the wines, because obviously that's really important. It is definitely really important. I'm so going to buy a bottle off you when I finish this diet and start drinking again.
And it is Friday.
Do you taste every single wine that you have, you know, you sell? Do you get to sample all of them, or do you sort of buy in stuff that you think? Because there must be some wines that, you know, like, I know with cakes, some people love, I sell banana cake, but I bloody hate it. You know, I hate it myself. I can't stand bananas. But people love banana cake. There are wines like that that you sell that you're not keen on, but other people absolutely love because, as you said, taste is relative.
If I can just return that question to you briefly. So when you're baking, do you taste?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Just to check. But, not always.
Okay.
Yeah.
But in answer to your question to me, yes, is the short answer. Yeah. I do.
Can I have your job?
I know. It sounds great, doesn't it? And I have taken people with me, and often, and I know there can be a struggle to keep up.
Yeah.
There is a routine you have. I become quite antisocial.
Okay.
Because when it's just focused.
Yeah.
So that there will be people around who'll interrupt me.
Yeah.
You know, friendly, Yeah. But then you engage, because in the trade like this, we talk, you know, it's nice. And that's part of the great things. But I quite liked, I'll do a run of maybe 8 to 10 wines.
Yeah.
Then I'll take a break and drink some water.
Yeah.
But you're spitting all the time. Mm. So at a trade tasting, on average, I could taste anywhere between 80 to 120 wines.
Yeah.
The difficulty comes, and to be fair, maybe 20 to 30% of those wines are new. I have never tried them before, so I'll spend more time on those. Yeah. 60 to 70% of them will be wines that I just want to see what the next vintage is like.
Right.
So it's just instinct.
Yeah.
And the rest will be, I have a random test.
Okay.
So I've got to keep learning.
Yeah.
We all do. And the only way I can learn is, I'm always saying to clients, try something new.
Yeah.
Well, I've got to do it too. So I just literally randomly look through a list and think, well, I'm going to try that.
Yeah.
And I'll try it. And if it registers something in me, then I'll go back to it.
Yeah.
So even if I'm tasting 100 to 120 wines, maybe 30 of those, more specific detailed notes.
Yeah.
Others is just what's the vintage like, and a few new ones that I will then go and taste again another time.
Okay.
But it's still relentless and drinking lots and lots and lots of water, because the palate, even though you're spitting, you will start to absorb a bit of alcohol and you need to keep hydrated.
Yeah,
I believe. Guess. Sorry, go on.
No, you carry on.
All right. I was going to say, I've had Martin in the corner there of H2 Productions producing this podcast. He said 5 minutes, 2 minutes, and that 2 minutes has already gone. And I'm now looking over at him, thinking, "Oh my God, we're going to overrun." So I'm going to ask you two quick questions, okay? Because I just can't believe the time's just disappeared. So what's the biggest challenge you're kind of facing in your role and business right now, to finish on, would you say?
I think it's going to be a common answer to this one. Time. I mean, you know, Sunny, what it's like. I mean, we all do, actually, Faye, because, you know, if you've got a family, you have key responsibilities. That's time as well. And we don't work to forget that. I mean, it's often what motivates us. It's time. Maybe we want it. Yeah. But I think that's such an important thing, is finding time and being better at managing time. So that is the challenge that I find I'm constantly looking at and evolving. So I'm constantly work in progress on time management.
Yeah, I think we're all work in progress on time management. As you
indeed,
say, it's
indeed.
Easy to waste time. Well, I think we've come to the end of it now, haven't we? But it's been fabulous talking to you, Carl. I could carry on talking to you for hours about wine and what you do, because it's so fascinating. But thank you very much for joining us on the podcast and telling us all about your business and a bit about wine.
It was a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Thanks, Carl.
Thank you.
Hubbub, the Directors Hub podcast, sponsored by the Sussex Business Show.